start the Q&A session. I think we've been getting a lot, so thank you very much. There are questions for each speaker. And so I'm going to hand it back to Wendy to pose the questions to our speakers.
Great. Thanks, Victoria. So the first question is for Maria from Louisville. And the question is, what was the tree canopy assessment a study of existing trees? If so, what metrics were collected, tree species, diameter, or was it a plan on where to plant new trees?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was trying to unmute. Can you repeat the beginning of that question?
Sure thing. So the basic question is, was the tree canopy assessment a study of existing trees or a plan on where to plant new trees? And if it was a study of existing trees, what metrics were collected? For example, tree species, diameter, that sort of thing.
Oh, okay, sure. So the tree canopy assessment is currently underway, and what it is an assessment of existing trees, but it's not an inventory, so it doesn't give us species diameter or any of that. But it includes planting scenarios to bring our canopy up to tree planting timelines and scenarios, as well as locations to get our canopy to 30%, 35, 40, and up to 45%. So it really is about a plan to increase our canopy. We're right now under like around 27-ish, and the central business district of our downtown is only 8%. So we have a long way to go.
Great, thank you. The next question is for Irene, and the person acknowledges that Tucson has planted 9,600 trees so far, and they ask, have you done an assessment of the impacts, and if not, are you planning to?
Right now, we have not done an assessment. One is because they're scattered pretty much around the city. Even though we've tried to identify the target neighborhoods, they don't always end up there. And we don't have a metric to measure its effect of that increased canopy. We are looking at that right now on how to do that metric, and even looking at some of Sharon, Dr. Harlan's data. It's doing that assessment side could entail a lot of different types of equipment, so we're not quite sure about that one as yet.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is for David. David, how cost competitive are the products and materials, construction, et cetera, for cool roofs, cool pavements, and the like?
I guess in terms of a cool roof, they're very cost competitive. Like I mentioned, if you go to the Cool Roof Rating Council's website, you'll see that there is well over 1,000 products that are available. And in terms of pricing, clay tiles, shingles, are you'll see that they are right in line with most traditional products. There are some sort of your cheapest asphalt shingles you can get slightly below what the cheapest or sort of lowest cost cool roof materials are out there, but that's about it. It's a very small percentage, so it is very cost competitive. In terms of cool pavements, this is sort of a new area. The materials we're working on, we don't have a cost estimate yet. We should actually have that within the next week. So I don't have a sort of definitive answer on that, but it is, like I said, sort of a new developing area, and there aren't a lot of products available right now.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so now we'll ask a question of Victoria. And the question is, when you say that there are strategies that can be adopted by property owners to mitigate UHIs, are there any studies on the affordability of these tactics, and do you see policy or incentives ahead that will drive adoption of these tactics?
Good question. At the Heat Island program, we have tried to keep track of research that has been done and studies that have been done on the economic issues. And also, we try to keep track of where funding is available for these measures. And so I do know that there has been some recent examination of this, and many cities, in addition to what, as David mentioned, do have rebates and tax credits. And there are the Energy Star program does have some information on their website as well about cool roof products that are that have tax credits applicable to them because they are energy efficient. So if you go, if you join our listserv, you'll get information about the latest economic studies and things like that that come out. But we are paying attention to that. It's an important question.
Great, thank you. So next we'll do another question for Maria. Can you elaborate on the land cover assessment portion of the project? What resources or tools were used, and was there any involvement with the USDA iTree tool?
Okay, so the land cover assessment, The land cover assessment is where we are using, or where Dr. Stone is using, high-resolution imagery and data from our GIS consortium here in town. So So we're not using iTree in that way. I have heard that there's something out there that's commercially available or that's available. It's something I've just recently heard about called iHeat, but we're not really using that either. I thought that was interesting though. It's pretty much GIS information and data that we have, like I said, from our local consortium, and it's down to the 2-foot level resolution. So it's very accurate and it's very detailed.
Great, thanks so much.
The question?
Sounds good.
Great.
That was great. So the next question is for Irene. Regarding the GIS tool that was used in Tucson, is this tool available for other areas, and would it contain the data layers on census, for in other words, the vulnerable population and tree cover?
I don't think, the layers that are available here on Tucson are, of course, very specific to this region only. But I think the census information, other cities could definitely use the same sort of data, because that's just census data. But you would have to create your own map utilizing your own resources if you have a GIS person who would be able to link the census data to the mapping. That would probably really help. So on that one map of the Arizona Health Services, it has on there the layers that they used from the census. And you may want to see whether or not those also apply in your community. The other one is that same slide also had Sharon Harlan's link on there, and you can read her report to see which elements she found affected those heat neighborhoods besides low income. And I think that for us was helping to drive some of that social justice data collection. And I think the Arizona Health Services also was basing that map on some of her data.
Okay, great. Thank you. The next question is for David. And I think you started to address this in your presentation, but the question is, how does the city promote residential cool roofs in areas where historic preservation requires dark shingles or metal roofing?
I guess there's sort of two things. One, a city, if it felt like there were a number of historic buildings where that was a concern, that could be an exemption in the ordinance. And the other thing I would say is that there are, because there are so many products now, that shouldn't be too much of a problem. And I'm sorry, just real quickly, one point I wanted to make that I didn't make earlier that I meant to during the presentation was, the urban heat island effect in Los Angeles contributes about 4 to 5 degrees of warming on average. And like I mentioned, in the middle part of the century, we're expecting 4 to 6 degrees of warming in Los Angeles. So a comprehensive urban heat island mitigation plan that focuses for LA on trees, cool pavements, and cool roofs can actually reduce temperatures, reduce the urban heat island effect 4 to 5 degrees. So if with sort of this comprehensive program, we can actually offset the warming that's expected late in the later part of this century.
Okay, great. Thank you. Another question for Victoria. Apart from learning what different communities are doing, is there information on which approaches have been most successful in practice?
I guess that depends on how you define success. We try to collect the case studies as I mentioned, and then we do these webinars as a way for the communities to talk to each other and learn about how they were successful and what that means. We try not to really promote one strategy over another. I would say each of those strategies that I mentioned as a mitigation option for the heat island effect has pros and cons. There are many, it's complicated in terms of estimating the economic success. And it also depends, I think, on what your success could mean, what your main priority is. For example, because Tucson has water issues, success for them is going to be different than maybe in Michigan where they have plenty of rain. And so it depends on what your community's priorities are. But if you read the compendium of strategies, you will learn what has been successful for the communities that we mention in there. And that, I think, can give you an idea of what is what might be the most successful, which ones have been the most successful. Because some communities also do measure the success. They quantify the temperature reductions that have occurred. Although that is a complicated thing to do, but they do measure also success in terms of the reduction in electricity use and consequent GHG reductions. So I think if you look at those case studies, you'll get a good idea of what might be considered most successful in general.
Great, thank you. So next I'm going to ask a question for all speakers. So whoever wants to jump in and chime in first, feel free. So the question is, have any of the speakers done or know of scientific research showing or proving that the air quality benefits of urban trees and vegetation? Also, have any of you dealt with the issue of trees that actually negatively contribute to ground level ozone formation? So a question about air quality.
Yeah, so I know the one about that air quality and the negative benefits. There are negative benefits that trees, and I think it came out of, I was just reading it this morning, although the study itself, even from the iTree, has come out that some trees do emit volatile organic chemicals, the VOCs, and when they interact with the nitrogen in the atmosphere and the UV light, that it does turn into that smog. So it's a bad air quality. Some of those trees are like oaks and eucalyptus, and other trees, I think like ash and something else, are less emitters. So they're much cleaner, and they do not emit that VOC into the air. But I always say, because we have a lot of oaks downtown, is that you have to weigh the benefits of everything. It's not just the air quality, but the shade, the heat. And even this one article was saying, you don't get rid of those high emitters, but just be more careful where you plant them. So you don't want to plant a whole mass of oaks along the roadways where cars are also emitting the VOCs, and just being more cognizant. As our research and our data comes up and we're learning more, we just have to start figuring out how to work with that. I don't know, did that answer it, some of it?
That's great. Would anybody else like to chime in?
Well, here in Louisville, we are in and out of attainment with our air quality constituents of concern. So I know that we have a direct correlation between heat, the temperature of the summer, and our ozone alert days. So it's proven that obviously heat is a precursor and contributes to the formation of ozone. So we here last year was a not so bad of a summer, so we were really lucky with our ozone alert days. We had fewer than usual. So we definitely keep an eye on that as it relates to air quality.
Anybody else want to chime in? Can we move on?
You know, I'm just going to add another thing. I know there was that question about iTree. So if you do an assessment of your trees and you know species and size of the trees, the iTree does have a model in which it does generate the air quality benefits. So if your community wants to take that on, and iTree is the software itself is through the USDA, so it's a free software that any community can use. You just have to learn how to use it.
Great. Okay, the next question I'll ask is for David. Do you know, are there any practical studies on use of cool roofs to mitigate the urban heat island effect? I know of one, the reader writes, I know of one study in Spain on greenhouses, but the rest of these studies seem to be computer modeled. Are there any real life studies now or any up and coming?
Yeah, I would point to work that's being done by Dr. Larry Kalkstein out of the University of Miami. He's a synoptic climatologist, and he's looked at several aspects, and some of that data or some of that research being on how cool roofs or cool surfaces and tree canopies can reduce the number of mortalities during extreme heat events. So he's done some really important work in this area, and I think you know his work would be the best place to go to see that data.
Great. And then our last question will be for both Maria and Irene. Are your studies looking at how a future climate resilient palliative tree species might differ from what has traditionally been appropriate?
I would say that it will change only because our climate zone is changing, that we are getting warmer. One, as I had said earlier, about the VOC emitting trees, that we'll probably start looking at that, which ones are higher and how will we figure out on planting them. But also some of the, because we're hot and cold, sort of determines the viability of a tree, that we may have less trees that we have today that are a little bit more cold tolerant. We may not be able to, they may change. The heat is marching upward from the south, so yes, the palette will change. But it may take a while to do that.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing that in Louisville as well. Our hardiness zone recently shifted, and we're incorporating those trees that, you know, 10, 20 years ago wouldn't have tolerated our harsh winters. So, yeah, we're really trying to include that in the mix of our reforesting plans for sure.
Great. Thanks so much. Victoria, shall we wrap up, or would you like me to ask some more questions?
I think it's about 2:30, so we probably should let folks go. Thank you all for those are great questions that you asked, and thanks to our speakers for answering them very well. I want to thank Maria, Irene, and David again for giving us your time today and helping us learn from your experience. I think it'll be really helpful to people. If you would like to read the presentations again, go to the Heat Islands website, and the address is up on your screen. In a couple of weeks, we will have audio transcripts of the presentations as well as PowerPoints so that you can see everything again or pass them on to others. And one reminder again is please sign up for our newsletter to keep informed of what's going on with EPA and Heat Islands and to learn about future webcasts as well. And I just thank you again for joining us on this day, as I said, when a very important sports event was happening. We appreciate that. Before you sign off, there will pop up some exit questions, which we hope you'll answer to help us learn how we did and make future webcasts better. So thanks again on behalf of EPA and our speakers for joining us. We really appreciate it, and we hope you have a good day. Thanks.
Thank you.
And this concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.